Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist and man about town, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the 2 weeks until summer hiatus show. We've abbreviated that with the acronym TWOOSH. This is our TWOOSH show. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the dedicated staff at the MSU Ronald G. Eagland Space Science Center. Now, I am joined in the studio today by assistant professor from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And Rick Phillips, the executive director of Networking and Infrastructure at UK, is off this weekend. And he has left Isonville and is on Broadway, watching a Broadway play. Rick Phillips on Broadway. So I'll just briefly tell you about our website, wmky.org. That's where you can listen to the show and the research and the comments and some additional material. You can find HM Radio Show. That's on Facebook. Please, by all means, visit the wmky.org website, and you can not only hear a reproduction of today's exciting broadcast drama, but also there are many other shows, both musical and news, there on that webpage. We are joined in the studio by station manager and all-around good guy. Now, we abbreviate that SMAG.
SMAG.
SMAG. Paul Hitchcock. He is our SMAG today for our TWOOSH show. You can see, I'm in a hurry. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm in a hurry. Everything needs to be abbreviated.
Okay, well, you have abbreviated.
Right, Shell?
yes, Tone.
Okay, our sponsor, which we want to take plenty of time with, this is breast cancer screening, 4 statements from the American College of Physicians. And this was, again, a repeat from last program, but I want to make sure that we really emphasize these 4 statements. And I think through a conversation, we'll get through these and kind of hit the highs and lows of the American College of Physicians breast cancer screening recommendations. Now, the American College of Physicians, they assessed 7 existing guidelines which address breast cancer screening. The problem is these guidelines used to come from certain government agencies, but again, those agencies, due to decreased funding, have given over the process to specialty societies. So now instead of 1 guideline for your cholesterol, for your high blood pressure, or for breast cancer screening, you will have, in this case, 7. In other cases, you may have less or more for all these different things. And this is a very confusing landscape to try to figure out, well, what blood pressure should I aim for? In the case of mammography, here are their recommendations looking at, again, both the aggressive and the less aggressive recommendations from a number of organizations. And they mentioned this would include the American College of Radiology, the American College of Surgery. There is a guideline also from the Preventive Services Task Force, which is an agency we pay a lot of attention to because they have different specialties involved, and they look at the expected benefits of a screening test, not necessarily just to themselves. These are the 4 principal recommendations based on a review of all of these guidelines. First of all, if you are a woman in your 40s and you are average risks, you do not have the BRCA gene, you do not have a first-degree relative, a sister or mother who had breast cancer, if you are in your 40s, the clinician should review the pros and cons of mammography, taking into account your preferences. And what they mean by that is, how do you see yourself? Are you willing to undergo extra procedures, possibly a biopsy, possibly some extra x-rays, in order to make sure as best you can that you don't have cancer? Or are you inclined not to associate yourself with the healthcare system any more than you have to? So if you can handle a certain degree of uncertainty, if you can, if you don't mind getting some additional tests to try to provide clarity, those are 2 really different mindsets going into screening.
Well, how do you feel about the baseline mammogram? Like, I've heard providers say that. Let's get a baseline mammogram as your first one.
But see, I mean, it's not like then that one's just going to be filed away. If that baseline mammogram shows something a little strange, then you're basically in that same diagnostic cascade where they're going to get additional cone down views. They may get an ultrasound. They may do a needle biopsy and so forth. So it sounds almost like, well, this one doesn't count. But this one very much does count. Your thoughts?
It does count, yeah. And even if it's if they don't find anything concerning or abnormal or unusual, then what do you do when it comes time for, you know, that year or 2 years out? What do you do? It confounds it a little bit, I think.
Right. Now, I stress to our Health Matters listeners, if you are a woman and you get a mammogram in your 40s, that mammogram may show an abnormality. That abnormality may be a cancer. That may save your life. But if we do that to everyone in their 40s, we are not going to save enough lives that we will be able to pick it up statistically. That is, you know, we cannot show that it prolongs the life expectancy if we do it in the population. There may be some big winners. There may be a person who has a car crash and dies on the way to get their mammogram. There may be a person who dies of some complication of the chemotherapy for the thing that they found or the next procedure. There are all sorts of possibilities. When you add all those possibilities together, we can't show that this is a good thing to do as a population. It may be wonderful for you, but it is not something we can recommend for everybody. And that's a tough thing. You know, we will not be able to pick up all the cancers that happen to women in their 40s. Even if we did all mammograms or CAT scans or anything else, we cannot find and cure every cancer.
Right. That's why it's so important to talk to your healthcare provider.
Right. Second recommendation, if you are 50 to 74, a clinician should offer every two-year mammograms. This is, again, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force went to every 2 years during this period because they could not tell the difference between getting, in terms of saving lives, between getting one every year or in every 2 years. That is a tough, I think we talked about it last time, it is tough to remember something 2 years from now. If you have a calendar, it's easy to remember something, or easier to remember something next year. But 2 years is tough, and that's one of the arguments against this. The other thing is, obviously, I mean, the closer you put it together, the less stuff you miss. But you're also accumulating a little bit of radiation, probably not enough to make a huge difference, to be honest. But still, extra procedures, extra possibilities, extra chances that they might see something that's really not there. Then three and four will go more quickly on these. Women ages 75 and older, or if you have a life expectancy less than 10 years, you should discontinue. And that is not saying that everyone over age 75 has a life expectancy less than 10 years. We really, what it's saying is we just don't know. There's not enough information to know what to do, and we may get better at this in the future, but right now we can't recommend it. And I think if we're going to do something like this, we have to have evidence that doing it is better than not doing it, and right now we don't. And then finally, regardless of age, the clinical breast examination, getting a professional to examine your breasts with their hands to see if they find a lump has not been shown to save lives. Better off that you actually do that yourself and you might find something. But as far as going to the office once a year for a professional to do that, that is no longer recommended. So our sponsor, Breast Cancer Screening Guidelines from the American College of Physicians. Now, in our promo for the show, we talked about skipping. And this was Reuters Health. It came out of East Carolina University, Greenville, North Carolina. And the authors reported that 79% of runners report injuries in any given year. This is in the online journal Gait and Posture. But they found that skipping produced half the peak force on the patella or kneecap. And it also was a third less peak force on the joint between your tibia and your femoral and your the tibia femoral joint, that is the joint between the leg bone and the shin bone. So the forces are less. Actually, skipping burns more energy, and also skipping is a way to reflect joy.
It sounds like pretty good cardio, too.
Right, and running is complicated, isn't it? I mean, you need to be able to run to play in athletics. So one of the things you do with your running is you practice the skill you will need to score the winning goal. Now, once you get to my age, I'm not going to score the winning goal.
Well, why not?
Even if I'm wide open, I won't score the winning goal.
Maybe.
I'm too old to score a winning goal.
Well,
there it's, I mean, Shelley, at some point you can't score the winning goal.
I'm trying to be positive here.
I understand. I appreciate your support, but you know, I mean, in your heart, you know I'm not going to score the winning goal. So the question is, why am I running like everybody else? Why don't I skip?
Well, why don't you skip?
I tried skipping. I mean, first of all, I was so self-conscious, I skipped inside in the hall after I made sure everyone else had left the building. I skipped. I can still skip. I wasn't even sure I could do it.
Yeah.
I could. I still skipped.
You could. Well, I'm not sure if I could. I might overthink
it. And I thought I would have my arms out, swinging my arms for skipping. As it turns out, I skip with my arms down at my side. I did not know that until I skipped. You should try it and see whether you skip with your arms out or not.
That'll be my homework for this next week.
But it does bring up, why do we all do exactly the same thing? We all run like we're going to score the winning goal. And also, Shelly and I talked, running. One of the goals of running, you run with your arms still in order to conserve energy. Because, again, you're thinking about the end of the game, you need that energy, or if you want to run an extra mile. But you exercise to burn off calories.
Right.
So instead of running with your arms at your side with good posture, you should probably just flail your arms and scream your way down the street.
Right.
And this brings up Pat McManus, A Fine and Pleasant Misery. Pat was an author for Field and Stream, who I think he died in 2016. But he talks about something called the full-bore linear panic. It's where you run flat out in a straight line until your course of your panic is deflected by a large rock or a tree. You get up and you sprint off in a different direction. It's also referred to as the ricochet or pinball panic, or sometimes simply as going bananas.
Pinball panic, I like that.
Well, I think the point is, you know, and you think about it, we run in a straight line. Mm-hmm. We run to conserve energy. We run quietly and orderly. Whereas if we simply panicked our way through the park, it would be a much more exciting spectacle. I mean, would you not go to see a panic? If you had 100 people panicking through a park, would that not be a thing to see?
I want to see a relay.
A skipping relay or a panic relay?
Either one. Either one. I would enjoy either one, I think.
Well, this is the challenge. When you're out there and you're thinking about doing a 5K run for some type of a charity, why not do a 5K panic instead?
5K
panic. The job is, you know, imagine that there's a hornet's nest behind you, or imagine that there's someone lurking in the bushes, and just panic your way to the finish line. It's going to burn off a lot more calories.
Right.
Probably it will reduce stress a little bit. Mm-hmm. And if you were to skip, say we have some skippers and some panickers, that may be a little bit easier on the knees.
I think this could start a whole new revolution in exercise.
Right. And the question is, why run when you can panic? That's the thing. And I know Paul's got some thoughts on this.
Yeah, I do. This is Paul, the overall nice guy you introduced earlier
the SMAG,
in the program.
The Health Matters SMAG.
So is there a minimum height that your feet have to be off the ground or your knees in the air to be considered a skip?
No, not a minimum height. But, Paul, one of the reasons you burn more calories is because skipping is both vertical and horizontal. That is, you're going to get more height when you skip than when you run. And once again, running is a very conservative activity, a way to cover ground conservatively, whereas skipping is obviously not.
I think we could be on the front end of this and we could write the rules.
Well, I think, do you think skipping would be like an Olympic sport? I mean, we have that, you know, the speed walking, which is absolutely ridiculous.
True.
I think skipping, you know,
would be more ridiculous.
However, speed walking is an event in Special Olympics. So it is a regular considered an event for Special Olympics. So they do speed walking.
But Paul, now I think about it. I mean, if those people could skip in the Special, I mean, sorry, could speed walk in the Special Olympics, skipping actually, I think, is less rules than speed walking. I mean, you've got to alternate feet and so forth. But I think if we had a standard skip, I think the kids, the young people in the Special Olympics could learn to skip as well. And I wonder how far a person could skip or how high they could skip if they were an Olympic skipper.
I was a pretty good skipper in college. I skipped Spanish. I skipped statistics quite often. I was very good at it.
So that's the last we're going to hear from Paul Hitchcock today.
But don't put a mic in front of me.
but you know, I mean, honestly, in terms of being creative about your exercise, there are many ways to burn calories, and skipping is actually these authors prove that it is easier on your legs, on your knees, and burns more calories than running. So it is something to think about. You can think about this during the break because we're going to take a break and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hi, and welcome back to the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the 2 weeks until summer hiatus, the Twoosh Show. We, in fact, this show and next week's show will be the last before we take a brief break. We're going to be off through the rest of June and through the 4th of July holidays, and then we come back the second week of July with our regular summer fare. We are very grateful to, again, to our Health Matters station manager and all-around good guy, the SMAG, Paul Hitchcock, who is here helping us out because these students have departed for their summer break. Our sponsor for the second time, the breast cancer screening, four statements from the American College of Physicians. I believe we talked about the first one to the point where nothing to say. Women ages 40 to 49, average risk. Clinicians should review the pros and cons of mammography, taking into account their preferences. For most women in this age group who are average risk, the harms are going to outweigh the benefits. You're going to get radiation earlier in your life. You're going to have more non-cancer abnormalities in the breast at this time in ratio to the actual cancers picked up. You will have probably more procedures done, and you will have a lower yield of picking up breast cancer. The other concern we have is it may be that in your 40s, if you develop a breast cancer, it grows so fast that if we do our regular yearly screen, we simply miss it, and it grows up. It comes up in between screens anyway. We're not sure that we can pick up breast cancers for women in their 40s in time to do good things for them. So these are some of the many problems we've encountered trying to screen women in their 40s. Now, once again, if you are a person who wants to know, you said, I don't want to take any chances with not knowing about cancer. I want to do everything I can to try to protect myself. Maybe there was a relative or a friend who died at a young age of cancer. Those are the type of things that influence your preferences. And that's perfectly understandable. If you lost someone you loved due to breast cancer, then you may want to get yourself screened for breast cancer in your 40s because you remember that, and that should be respected, and we should accommodate that. On the other hand, if you are a person who does not really want to have to, in your 40s, you've got a lot of other things to do besides go to the healthcare facilities. You're willing to tolerate the uncertainty about these things, and you know that there is not, on a population basis, proof that this will save or extend your life, then you may decide you're not going to fool with it, and no one should pressure you into doing it if you do not want to do it. That's age 40 to 49. And Shelley, after saying we'd exhausted it, I just spent more time with that one again.
You've exhausted it again.
Yeah, Paul.
What about the family tree services, like the DNA tests? Do they help,
you know,
expose some background information?
Well, we've looked. I can't say specifically about – let me just say, if you get the 23andMe if you get the Ancestry.com genetics, those are right now not considered reliable. As a matter of fact, I didn't bring the story in, but there was a columnist who sent his dog's DNA in, and his dog apparently was Celtic and related to the Vikings, just like Rick. The point is, you know, they are, and I don't mean to paint all these services with the same brush, but they have not reached the point where they provide reliable data on individual risks that you can use to make clinical decisions in those settings. If you look at the medical facilities that are doing genetic analysis, they usually start with a clinical condition, and then they do the genetic analysis to see whether that, in fact, does run in your family or whether it's an isolated occurrence. But just doing genetic screening right now, not recommended, and we're not quite good enough at that. But the other thing, that has not reached the level of accuracy that we need to even try it. We have looked at things like MRI scans, ultrasounds, and other types of tests, and so for as a population screen, when you look at how much money you spend on that, what the yield is, none of those things has been pays off. Right now, as we said, we're actually dropping things like a clinical exam. Why would you drop a clinical exam? I mean, it's pretty easy to do. It doesn't take much time. That's true. But in terms of what we pick up from the clinical exam, you come in, you have no idea there's any problem. A person who has some kind of degree examines your breasts and says, "Oh, I've found a cancer," and you decide, and that saves your life. That scenario almost never happens.
But that's very different from the self-breast exams, which could pick up something that needs to be checked out.
I think that makes. I think it just makes sense at this point. It is up to you. We can't prove that that is good for everyone to do, but it just makes sense. Why would a person not check and see? Because a new lump in the breast, however it is discovered, is something that you have to worry about. But turning yourself over to someone who's going to do a breast examination and find something you couldn't find on your own examinations, that doesn't seem to be a good strategy. And then between ages 50 and 74, every two-year mammograms are what they are recommended. You may want to get them more frequently than that. Talk that over with your healthcare provider, but every 2 years is what they're recommending. And then stop at age 75 or with a life expectancy of 10 years or less. Now, if everyone in your family lived to age 105, breast cancer does not go away at age 75. You have to think about what you want to do. One of the problems is Medicare is not going to fork over money for your longevity. They will be glad to provide you with basic services, but that's going to come out of pocket if you decide that you want to continue after age 75. Their guidelines say stop at 75. Or certainly, I think this is the thing we're not very good at. I can't tell you right now which of the patients I saw today has less than 10 years to live. There are always surprises. Things happen differently, and we can't predict that far out. So it's easy for them to say, well, if there's a life expectancy less than 10 years, cancer screening probably is not going to be that beneficial. But in practice, I have a very difficult time sorting my patients out into less than 10 years and greater than 10 years. And when you get down to 2 or 3 years, we start to get a little better. We can see the writing on the wall. This is not going well. But I have a lot of difficulty, especially with people, again, in their 60s and 70s, trying to figure out if they're going to make 10 or not. The average life expectancy at age 65, the average life expectancy at age 65 is 15 years. So you're, you know, that 10 plus or minus 10, as you get older, again, when you get in your 70s, you see why they stop at 75. Because, again, you've already hit that 15 years that is average for people. You've hit the 10 out of the 15 that are average for people at age 65. So it's probably time for most people to stop. But, again, you may be that person, in which case maybe there's an alternative, but we don't have it right now. Our sponsor, that's enough talking. Breast cancer screening from the American College of Physicians. All right. Let's think together for a minute. Annals of Family Medicine, May 13th, Robert Kaplan and Arnold Milstein, Stanford University of Medicine Clinical Excellence Research Center. They looked at how much health care affects your risk for premature death. That is, how much can we change your life expectancy by providing you with good health care? And they ran four different methods. These are statistical methods looking at life expectancy, looking at outcomes of having good access to health care, having good health care, quality health care, and compared to other things. And all four methods said health care accounts for between 5 and 15%, and you want to average it, roughly 10%, of the variation in premature death. So if Shelley and I go to different parts of the country, and I'm roughing it, and I may not be able, a doctor's an hour away, and she's living right next to the doctor's office, high quality health care, on standby, waiting for whatever she needs, a 10% difference about in our life expectancies. It is not zero. It is nothing to sneeze at, but it is not the big thing. Behavioral and social factors account for 16 to 65%. And with that, we're talking about your socioeconomic status. We're talking about where you live. We're talking about your education status. Those are the type of things that have the lion's share of the difference.
And we kind of do it backwards here in the United States, don't we? We want to have everybody close to services. We want everybody to have access to anything they could possibly want. But it doesn't account for as much as...
You know, and you're right, and I'm especially concerned with the healthcare system. I mean, we have one job, and that is to try to help people to live longer, healthier lives. And we have chosen to do that with partnering with the pharmaceutical industry to produce more and more drugs, with doing expensive transplant surgeries, laser surgeries, reconstructive surgeries, creating specialists who make enormous amounts of money but don't really add to life expectancy. Meanwhile, we have neglected the basic things people need. And this is very frustrating. If we truly want to help our patients live longer, We need to change these social factors. We need to provide more social support for the patients, and we're not going to get there by spending $4 trillion on advanced medical care.
Right.
The difference there, 10% versus 16 to 65% between health care and social and economic factors.
Well, there's people, though, that go to the doctor. Every time they sneeze, they're overly medicated.
Right. Well, and Paul, you know, when you look at our specialty society guidelines, if your cholesterol is this number, you get a cholesterol pill. If your blood pressure is this number, you get one, two, or three blood pressure pills. And so we, and as a physician, I am held to that. That is quality care. How much money I get paid to see you depends upon whether I provide quality care. And quality care is almost always more pills and more treatments. And very seldom is quality care, very, very seldom is quality care walking away from a complaint or a problem instead of addressing it with medicines. So we wind up with people on 15 or 20 medicines in their 70s, which is not a healthy thing, and we don't have any guidelines on how to stop them. We just have guidelines on how to add more.
And we also don't assess the other things that impact health care very well, like safe housing, safe neighborhoods, access to exercise, access to nutrition, access to clean water. All those things have come up in the news over the past several years, and that's not gotten any better. So it doesn't matter what pills I give my patients if they can't eat nutritious food and they can't live in a safe place.
And then there's that 1% that never see a doctor in a day in their life.
Yes. Right. Now, I've watched our healthcare system descend from what was arguably, and I was one of the ones arguing, the greatest healthcare system in the world. And many people thought we had that in the 1980s. Well, I didn't think we did, but still, they did, to the point where I think everyone agrees that this is seriously broken. And despite the efforts of the previous Obama administration to try to improve affordability and access, that was more of a Band-Aid, and now we're looking at abandoning our current healthcare system, basically, and trying other systems. One of the things they mentioned, a book by Elizabeth Bradley and Lauren Taylor, they compare the amount the United States spends on non-medical social services with other wealthy Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, how much they spend on it. On the average, other countries spend $2 on non-medical services, education and social services program, for every $1 spent on medical care. By contrast, the United States spends about 55 cents for every $1 spent on medical care. So we clearly have decided to put all of our eggs in the medical care basket, eliminate the other programs, and you can see that. We've paid for Medicaid expansion in the state of Kentucky, and we've done that by cutting our support for education.
And that's a chicken and an egg. You know, we need more money for Medicaid expansion because people aren't healthier.
Yeah.
You know, and that
Medicaid expansion is working. It is doing a wonderful thing, but it's sad that we had to do that to do those things. You're absolutely right.
Right. And if it was flipped, you know, it's a problem that's going to perpetuate. You know, it's going to be hard to break that cycle and flip it now, I think.
I think we're raising another generation now of people who don't have access to education, which gives them access to a better socioeconomic status and also the education itself. None of that is happening, and so then we're going to have to spend more money on their health care because we did not take the time to educate them when they were young.
I wonder what the average distance is across the United States between people in their family doctor or medical services or a hospital. Is it 1 mile, 2 miles, 3 miles? The average distance across the U.S.
I don't know about the average, Paul, but what we've done is we look at a 30-mile radius around a healthcare center. And this is one of the problems. We oftentimes talk about healthcare services by county, as if a county was an appropriate unit. And what a lot of planners say is that everyone should be within 30 miles. There are obviously, and we mostly hit that in some of the rural areas here, although, again, the healthcare facilities we're accessing are not as completely staffed, not as well-funded as the ones that are in urban areas. Once you get out, obviously, to the Midwest and further, sometimes that distance can increase. If a hospital closes, sometimes it could be 3 hours, 200 miles to the next healthcare facility.
Well, that's where telemedicine comes into.
It can. One of the things about telemedicine that bothers me is that the physician is not a part of the community. And if we are right, if the community and the community values are important in trying to protect a person's health, then we throw the telemedicine is strictly healthcare. And doesn't give any other benefits to the community. They simply, when the TV turns off, the doctor vanishes, and their family obviously doesn't have anything to do with the community themselves. So you lose that aspect. It is, in my mind, much better to have physicians being a part of the community and trying to maximize these non-office, non-medical things that we're talking about. And these would be things like sidewalks. They'd be things like shade. They'd be things like exercise facilities and so forth. If you don't live in the community, you don't care. And then you wind up being only a medical provider, and that's only a small part, of what our role should be as healthcare providers in our communities.
Well, that's the thing. I think medical providers, healthcare providers, have found themselves carrying this weight of healthcare. You know, healthcare is much bigger than the medical provider, and we've lost all these other pieces, like you've mentioned, the clean water, the green spaces, the whatever recess for kids, you know.
And I put this in. We've had a nice conversation, and actually I've gotten off track again. Thank you very much, Shelley.
You're welcome. That's my job.
But this was from Medscape, which is a news feed that I get. And this was May 14th, and they were talking about high fructose corn syrup's possible role in intestinal cancer. This is David Johnson, professor of medicine and chief of gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk. High fructose corn syrup, that's the stuff that we flavor a lot of foods with because it's cheaper than sugar. It has a different metabolic pathway than sugar. Sugar, basically, the more you eat, the more you absorb. That's not good for your diabetes, but the sugar gets into your system. High fructose corn syrup is so sweet, you eat it, and then you absorb some of it, but a lot of it stays in your gut. And when it stays in your gut, it coats the cells of your gut and gives them food. Now, you can imagine if you give some disturbed cells, maybe they're irritated, maybe they're inflamed, you give them extra food, the chance that they will turn into cancer becomes more likely. And in fact, the research that Dr. Johnson was talking about used mice who were likely to get colon polyps. They gave them basically one soda a day, high fructose corn syrup, which is what you would get, say, with a Mountain Dew or a Coca-Cola or Pepsi. And they found there was a significant increase in polyps and colon cancer in the mice. This does not prove, we are not mice, and this does not prove that we will get cancer. But we know that our rates of colon cancer, particularly at a young age, are rising. And we've been dining on high fructose corn syrup now since the Nixon administration, basically. That's when they decided, after having difficulty in getting sugar, to emphasize high fructose corn syrup.
So now you're going to bring up Sodagate?
Yeah, well, Earl Butz, their Secretary of Agriculture, who was famously drummed out of office after making racist comments, he was the one, after we had run into problems getting cane sugar from Cuba, decided we would grow our own substitute, and that was the high fructose corn syrup. And so then it became a regular part of our diet. Before then, we'd not done it. Now, the reason I bring up high fructose corn syrup is, one, we can take those polyps out. We can hire an army of gastroenterologists to use their colonoscopes to go in and scope everyone, take those polyps out, and reduce our risk of colon cancer. Or we can stop coating these things with sugar.
What an idea.
And in that case, this would simply be something like we talked about, I think, a couple of weeks ago, putting a tax on these sugar-sweetened beverages. And I just read an article where fruit juices are pretty much the same thing. That is, when you have high sugar content beverages, they cause trouble. And these high fructose corn syrup, colas especially, seem to be problematic. So the question is, do we then invest our money in trying to find colon cancer, which is not a bad thing. I certainly am not against that. Or could we change the environment, tax these beverages so that they're not as widely used, and maybe prevent the cancers from occurring in the first place? Now, this is a lot of speculation. I am not here to say that Mountain Dew causes colon cancer. I got my suspicions, but I don't want to make just a wild and inaccurate and unproven statement on the show. This is what our radio show is all about. I want you to understand this is a possibility. I think if we were to invest as much money into our environmental situation, invest as much money into our society, education, and directing people to healthier lifestyles, it's going to pay off more than creating more doctors, more hospitals, more lasers, more genetic analysis, all those those things. So that so we've come out again. We just had our gubernatorial primary, and none of the candidates mentioned changing the lifestyles, and certainly no one at this point in the state of Kentucky is going to talk about raising taxes in any way, except I suppose legalized gambling.
We're gonna increase gaming, but we're not gonna put taxes on stuff that we know will make money because people keep buying it.
Yeah. And we have that opportunity to change behavior. We're going to ignore that, and we're instead going to hopefully make more healthcare facilities to make up for the things that we don't do. We're not going to start any new articles now. We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hi, and welcome back to the final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Twoosh Show. 2 weeks until summer hiatus. We have a show this Saturday and Sunday, and then we have a show next Saturday and Sunday, and then we're going to take some time off and let you recover your senses. Hopefully, the wounds will heal, and we will be back the week after the 4th of July. So enjoy your time off, and we will be collecting horrible things to discuss in the month of July and thereon. We are joined for the final time in the studio with the station manager and all-around good guy, our SMAG, Paul Hitchcock. And thanks, Paul, for sitting in and producing our show.
Glad to be here.
And he can edit it. You know, the thing about, you can't really argue with Paul because he will edit it so that he wins the argument.
True.
You know, this is,
yes.
This is the problem with arguing with an editor is you're just going to look bad. You basically
you end up with a very biased show.
That is true. Our sponsor.
I will never do that to you.
I appreciate that. The final time here, the four statements from the American College of Physicians regarding breast cancer screening. And rather than belabor them, I'm going to go another direction on this, which I think you might like, Shelley.
Okay.
First of all, let's remind you those four directions. If you are a woman, average risk, you are not carrying the BRCA gene, you do not have a first-degree relative who had breast cancer. You are 40 to 49. Clinicians review the pros and cons of mammography, taking into account your preferences. But the American College of Physicians says for most women, harms outweigh benefits. Now, that is a really kind of a broad statement, and you have to look at your individual preferences in your 40s. But there should be no pressure to get them because society says it's good for you. That is not true. For women ages 50 to 74, offer mammograms every other year. This is in line with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations. Over age 75, life expectancy less than 10 years, discontinue screening at that time. And then finally, regardless of age, clinical breast examinations, where someone examines your breast with their hands, not recommended as a part of routine medical care. Those are their recommendations. Now, I put this in because I found this. This was in something called Becker's Hospital Review, a study published in the journal Radiology May 7th. A deep learning model, this is artificial intelligence, deep learning model trained in mammography, can predict the development of breast cancer up to 5 years in advance. This is from MIT. They used known cancer outcomes, and they had the deep learning, they had the artificial intelligence review 89,000 mammograms of almost 40,000 women, to train the model to recognize patterns in breast tissue. So what they would do is they would find women and they would who had breast cancer or didn't have breast cancer. They would note that fact, and then they would show the computer the mammograms preceding the breast cancer. And the computer then learns things that humans can't quite detect, patterns and its analysis, and it can pick them up. It accurately characterized 31% of cancer patients as high risk, while traditional models only identified 18%. It was equally accurate for people of all races, and that's been a problem because apparently sometimes we teach computers to be racist, and this one was not. So it should be more effective for non-whites. Now, this is the same question I've got about the cancer dog You know, they can smell cancer. Mm-hmm. If the computer says you're going to get cancer in 5 years, mm-hmm. are you going to have surgery based on the computer reading? Because it's never happened before. You know, we can't give you 5 years lead time. But a computer says you are likely to get cancer in 5 years.
Well, isn't that sort of what happens right now anyway? You have this computer image. Now a human interprets it, but
right.
you have a computer image.
And the human
image.
Interprets it in a way that, you know, we've come to accept. So this is a different thing. Mm-hmm. Like I said, if the dog says you get cancer, I mean, mm-hmm. the research says the dog's pretty good at diagnosing cancer. Mm-hmm. If the dog starts barking in front of your x-ray, are you going to have surgery based on a dog barking?
So are you implying that it depends on the delivery, the message, how it's worded, how it's phrased?
Do you think, I could just see that the cancer has to have some type of a human voice, I guess a C-3PO, right. you know, something like that.
Right.
And right. it says, oh my, oh my.
So if I don't know whether it's the radiologist or the AI, the artificial intelligence calling me.
Yeah, and so
you know, then
first of all, I've got to tell you, I got well, computer says you're going to get cancer.
Right.
And then you've got to figure out what to do with that. I mean, it's wonderful to have these models. It's wonderful to have advances like this, but I don't know how you bring this into society. I don't know how that works. Because I don't know. Did they really test this? Is this applicable?
It's an interesting idea. I'm not trying to demean or take away from the serious conversation that we're having, but do you trust Alexa when she tells you the weather? You ask her the weather and she tells you, do you trust her?
Yeah, I do.
So does it come down to trust? Do I trust the source, whether the source is a human or a...
I will say, you know, if I'm having a... I don't trust Alexa. I mean, I think she can do the weather because I think she looks and just basically reads the data that comes off the weather service. I think she's capable of that. Now, if I were thinking, well, Alexa, can you tell me if my daughter is mad at me? You know, look at her email. Do you think she's upset with me, or do you think this just
she's busy?
Yeah, and so that's why she didn't send me she didn't thank me for all that I've done for her.
Right. Right.
And if Alexa says, yep, she's pretty mad. No, you just raised a thankless daughter. Would I believe that sort of thing where Alexa has not demonstrated an expertise before? So mm-hmm. I'll refine your question a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Alexa comes up and is doing some new tricks. And mm-hmm. the question is, I kind of got to know what they're based on. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, 89,000 mammograms, 40,000 women who did and didn't have breast cancer. Alexa knows a lot about diagnosing breast cancer. She's read more mammograms than any radiologist on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Is that good enough? It's, you know, because, I don't know.
It's an interesting,
and the
know,
thing
almost
is, Alexa,
an ethical question.
You realize, I mean, the thing about this deep learning is it's not like they equivocate. It's not like, well, you know, this looks a little funny. I think we better just keep an eye on it. They just say, right. You know, 37.3% chance. Done. I mean, that's it. And right. and that's not the way I'm used to getting the information. You know,
right.
So what is it, 37.3? It's less than 50. But that's a lot.
I think that's how we're going to start getting information, though.
Yep. I guess so.
So then I guess we have to figure out how to build trust with the sources or the deliverer of the information.
That's our sponsor, Breast Cancer Screening. I have no idea where to go with that. Next up is something that I have actually used with some of my patients. I wanted to mention it. This was in Vox, V-O-X, Sarah Cliff, and her last name is K-L-I-F-F, if you're keeping score. May 16th describes a situation. Now, I'm going to read the situation because, again, I've cited the source here, and I want to explain this. This is Lindsay Clark, who had a 2-year-old daughter. They found her with some of their Dramamine, and she had kind of a white crust in her mouth. She had taken Dramamine. They don't know how much their 2-year-old daughter had taken, but she got her hands on some Dramamine, and they called poison control, like any good parent would. And poison control said, well, it could cause seizures if the concentration gets high enough. So they grabbed her. They got as much of the Dramamine out of her mouth as they could, and they rushed her off to the ER waiting room.
Okay.
they did not have the money to pay for an ER visit. And some of those ER visits, they'll run $1,000 just going through the door.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, all right, we're going to keep her in the ER waiting room. We're going to play with her for a couple of hours there. If anything happens, she's right there. If nothing happens, we're going home. Nothing happened. They went home.
It's a reasonable strategy.
Well, I've had some patients. They said, I don't know if I can take this medicine. I might be allergic to it. I said, well, why don't you just stop by the ER waiting room, take your first dose there, get some water from the water fountain, sit for about 15 or 20 minutes, and you go home. Or vaccines or things like that. I mean, this is a strategy. And she points out they did some surveys, and this is a commonly used strategy. I won't say commonly, but this is certainly more than one person uses this strategy. The idea of being close to the emergency facility rather than paying the money to actually be observed in the emergency facility.
I sort of, in a way, kind of appreciate that because they don't know if it's an emergency yet, right?
Right.
So if we want to conserve our emergency, you know, providers, our emergency resources, then I don't know, it's kind of a win-win.
Well, the downside, you gum up the ER waiting room. You may expose yourself to
whatever
there in the ER waiting room. It's a concern,
yeah.
But let's face it, if you're at a bus station or you go to a public school or anything like that,
Walmart,
you're going to, or a private school, mm-hmm. You're going to expose yourself to a lot of stuff there. If you go to a rec league baseball game or a little league mm-hmm. or something like that, you're certainly going to expose yourself to a lot of germs. And we make that choice willingly. We say, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. that's no big deal. So I don't want people to be terrified of the emergency room waiting room. But on the other hand, those are the downsides. The upside is, again, your response time, if anything goes wrong, drops dramatically. Now, you know, you miss out on the ER doing something. You know, it's not like
right.
they just they will observe the child's vital signs, the heartbeat to make sure that it is regular, observe for any of the side effects we commonly see with the medications, which might give us a clue that, in fact, this child did take a pretty large amount of Dramamine. In some cases, can pump the stomach or can get a urine sample and look for evidence of the drug in their urine. But they thought, you know, well, we'll take our chances.
It's interesting.
We'll save a ton of money.
And particularly, you know, we take care of a lot of patients who don't have the resources to pay for an ER visit.
Well, I think that's where we did that with a couple of medications is from the free clinic.
Mm-hmm.
They were worried, and we said, look, why don't you do this, and let's see if you're able to tolerate it, and that way you won't get charged.
Because the consequences of you know, having a large ER visit bill, that can be pretty devastating to these families, particularly if the emergency never happened and there wasn't an intervention. It was just monitoring.
Yeah. I've mentioned it, and I can't endorse it. I think that would be irresponsible. But for people that are really that are concerned, they might need health care.
Mm-hmm.
There's an alternative to either stay at home or be admitted to the hospital. You at least have there are shades of gray in between. It's something to think about.
Do most mm-hmm. hospitals have a basic fee just to walk in the ER?
Yes.
Whether they do anything or not, there's a basic
fee. If you're assessed mm-hmm. in the emergency room, there is that basic fee. And that basic fee is more than a clinic. So people try to go to clinics, which makes more sense. We actually, Paul, we had on the show, it's been probably a few weeks ago, Walmart, you know, the ERs will advertise their wait time, which if you think about it, you should not. That's not what an emergency room should do.
Right.
That is, if it is for emergencies, the wait time is absolutely the last thing you worry about. And Walmart, mm-hmm. in the area of their headquarters in Benton, Arkansas, they have forced their hospitals to take those wait time signs down because they feel like that promotes use of the ER for things that if you're going, it's only 5 minutes, I guess I'll go to the ER, then you, in fact, are using the ER for the wrong thing.
Right.
So,
and the strategy that you've mentioned is... That's interesting if you live in an area where it may be a 3-hour drive or 2-hour drive to get to the nearest ER. You know, if you think something might, you know, happen.
Right. So, especially for people in a rural area, just being close to a healthcare facility may provide some mm-hmm. additional cushion, some additional mm-hmm. Reassurance. So this is not an empty strategy. It's sad. It's a workaround. And we really should be able to do better. But if we can't, right. then we've got this.
Right.
Well, it's time to get off the air, so we need to get started. Special thanks to our Morehead State public radio producer and all-around smag, Paul Hitchcock. Also to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire or visiting our digital empire. Either one will work.
That works.
Just whichever way you want to do it.
Yeah.
Listen to the show. It's WMKY.org. Or visit us on Facebook. Look for HM Radio Show for our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC. Thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is used with a proper diet and exercise program and possibly with other radio shows to control high blood sugar. Nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness, or metallic taste in the mouth may occur. If any of these effects persist or worsen, tell your doctor or pharmacist promptly.
Health Matters can rarely cause a serious and sometimes fatal condition called lactic acidosis. Stop listening to Health Matters and get medical help right away if you develop any of the following symptoms of lactic acidosis. Unusual tiredness, classic lactic acidosis, dizziness, severe drowsiness, chills, cold skin, muscle pain, slow heartbeat, stomach pain with nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea.
Read the patient information leaflet, if available, from your pharmacist before you start listening to our show and each time there's a break. If you have any questions, consult your doctor or pharmacist.
Tell your doctor immediately if any of these conditions occur or if you notice a big change in your overall health. You may need to stop listening to our show temporarily. The elderly are at higher risk from our show, especially those older than age 80 who have not had kidney tests.
Health Matters does not usually cause low blood sugar. However, low blood sugar may occur if our show is prescribed without other anti-diabetic radio shows.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.